Welcome to number 18 of the First Responder Wellness Podcast, the show where we talk about wellness, mental health, leadership, and what it takes to have a wellness culture within your organization. My name is Conrad Weaver, and I want to wish you a very happy new year. I hope you've had a great holiday season and are setting yourself up for a successful 2024. And I'm so glad you've joined me today as I have one of my favorite psychologists on the show today. Originally from Australia, Dr. Phil Bakui is a licensed mental health professional with a very unique set of skills. In addition to a master's degree in counseling and a doctorate of psychology, he holds a black belt in martial arts, and he is a law enforcement firearms instructor, certified in high-risk global protective operations, and a trained hostage and crisis negotiator. Dr. Bakui is currently based in Oxford, Mississippi, where he runs a clinical practice, and he has trained Army Special Forces, Navy SEALs, first responders, U.S. Marshals, the DEA, U.S. Border Patrol, and other federal and state law enforcement agency professionals. Dr. Bakui had also a significant role in our award-winning documentary, PTSD 911, and I'm really thrilled to consider him a friend. Stay tuned for my conversation with Dr. Phil Bakui. Hey, I really appreciate you listening to this podcast. You know, there are so many podcasts out there, and I appreciate you taking time to listen to this one. It's a brand new year, and I would love for you to do me a small favor. If you would take a minute to write a review and leave a rating on Apple Podcasts, that would be amazing. This would really mean a lot to me and would also help others to learn about this show. And if you're watching this on YouTube, be sure to subscribe and hit the notification bell so that you know every time we upload a new video. Thanks again for listening, and thanks for sharing this podcast. And now here's my conversation with Dr. Phil Bakui. Well, Dr. Phil Bakui, welcome to the podcast. Thanks for joining me today.
Conrad, it's my pleasure to see you again, and thank you for the invitation.
So just for the audience to know that I'll call you Dr. Phil because that's kind of what you call it, even though you're not the Dr. Phil, but you are the Dr. Phil to me. So Dr. B, he was featured in our film PTSD 911 and gave some really amazing experts information about PTSD in our film. So thank you again for being here and being a part of the show. So what's been happening in your life? What have you been up to lately?
Well, since the filming and since the premiere, which I came to join you for, mm-hmm. Which was great, by the way, just been continuing to do the work that I'm doing. So I own a couple of mental health clinics, and so we have around 27 therapists between two locations in the state of Mississippi. And then I do a lot of work with the federal agencies as well. So primarily the DEA, Drug Enforcement Agency, as a clinician, but also as a trainer. So I've been doing a lot of work training their SRT teams, which is their special response teams, or the SWAT, basically. Mm-hmm. So high performers in law enforcement, and then also high performers in special operations military as well.
Mm-hmm. I know those kind of groups, and I can imagine what folks like the DEA, what kind of stuff they experience. So what kind of training do you do with them? And what are you seeing as the response from that?
So the majority of the work I do with the DEA is stress response and stress inoculation training. So helping the special agents understand and learn about what's happening for them physiologically and psychologically in a cognitive sense. And then also from an environmental perspective, helping them see the way that how they operate under stress dramatically affects how they interact and the decisions that they make in their environment. And so when you're under a very high stressful situation in a tactical sense, it's important that you make really good tactical decisions. And so by being able to recognize that it's not just about how well we train tactically with weapons, in other words, being a good shot at understanding, you know, tactical maneuvers, it's not just about how physically fit we are, because these guys they're the best of the best. They're the cream of the crop. They're all studs, you know, no big bellies with these police officers. I mean, they're all jacked up, drinking lots of protein shakes, you know. And But it's not just about that. It's not just about knowing the law. It's not just about the tactics. It's not about the physical aspects of it, even though those are vitally important. But interestingly, the one thing that holds all of those together to be able to be an efficient law enforcement officer is what's up here. Hmm. And across the board, not just to be able to be an effective operator in the field and an effective tactician, but also how one functions outside of the tactical environment when they're working one-on-one or within the context of their group. And then to me, I think even more importantly is how they're functioning when they don't have their badge on. You know, who are they when they're at home? And how is the stress that they're experiencing showing up in their home lives? And so helping these guys and girls learn about what stress response looks like physiologically and psychologically, how that tends to manifest itself, things to look out for, and then giving them tools and tips to be able to then mitigate that. So basically dealing with a lot of these issues on the front end of stress, which is what I call pre-zilience training rather than resilience training.
And this is stuff that isn't necessarily covered, I mean, generally in any kind of training in their ramp up to becoming an officer, right?
Nope. So the average law enforcement officer or the average police academy gets between 4 to 8 hours of what we'll call mental health training, which is usually consisted of a death by PowerPoint. Quite often you might have a therapist up there, and no offense to my profession because I'm a therapist, but a lot of us are a bunch of wet noodles when it comes to working with law enforcement or first responders. Mm-hmm. Like a lot of us don't know how to relate to a first responder. The amount of times I've had guys and girls come into my office who tell me their horror stories from seeing therapists, because unless you know how to relate, unless you're culturally competent to know how to work with a first responder, they first of all sense fear. And you have to know how to engage with them. Otherwise, they will not come back. Sure. They will not open up to you. And so it's a really tough, it's a tough audience, mm-hmm. and it's a tough group of men and women, and who in a way have had to harden themselves in order to be able to do their job to protect our communities.
Mm-hmm. And you bring some additional experience because you kind of had a history of in law enforcement and the military, right?
I had a short time in law enforcement, yeah, and the military, and then also private security contracting as well. So that all goes in, I think, to add, you know, some level of credibility to working with these guys because, you know, they don't want to shrink up the front just, you know, as I mentioned, with some PowerPoint presentation telling them a bunch of stuff that's really irrelevant. Mm-hmm. And so it's important to be able to hit home and really hit on stuff that really is meaningful and matters. And so one of the things I do actually at the start of the presentation or the training, it's called Tactical Presilience is the name of the training that I do. The first thing I do right out the gate is I give a bunch of these assessments out to do for each participant. And I have them fill it out. And on the assessment, it very specifically doesn't say what it's for. I just have them fill it out. It's just questions. They answer the questions and it's got a scoring metric on there, mm-hmm. you know, based on how they answer the questions, what their score is. And then I have them write the score at the top front of the page and leave it anonymous. I don't want anyone's name on it. And I have them hand it in. And what I do is as the program progresses, I calculate all of the scores from the assessments and give them actual feedback on it so they can see. So the very first assessment I do with these guys and girls is a PTSD self-reporting scale. Hmm. They don't know that. Right? And it's fascinating. Consistently, I have around 60% response rate that would indicate from this self-reporting scale based on the way they answer the questions, 60% of these first responder participants identify as having PTSD.
Wow.
60%.
Wow. And if you look at national averages, they say what, 30 to 40%, something like that?
Yeah, the stats vary. Yeah. The stats vary. And honestly, it's really hard with this stuff because I think a lot of the time officers don't answer truthfully.
Sure.
Like I've noticed in the training when I have officers or first responders sitting too close to one another when they're filling this stuff out, my scores are much lower, you know.
And even when they don't know what it is, right?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I also run the ACEs as well. Adverse Childhood Experience, a 10 question survey, very, very powerful.
What's the average score there? Do you know?
Usually around the same.
Wow.
It's usually a score above four or more ACEs. So for any listeners or viewers that are not familiar with the ACE protocol or the ACE survey, I don't know if you've covered this on here before.
I don't think I have.
Okay, yeah, it's worthwhile just hitting it real quick.
Sure.
So basically, and I may get some of this, I hope I get this right. So roughly in the 90s, there was a group of doctors in a weight loss clinic in California that that found there was a subgroup of their patients who would come in to their clinics, lose weight, but then leave their clinic and then put the weight back on and never come back to lose it again. And the doctors couldn't figure out, well, what are we doing wrong here? Mm-hmm. And so they interviewed their patients, and what they discovered, it actually wasn't that they were doing anything wrong. What they found was this specific subgroup of patients had high levels of trauma in their childhood, and specifically sexual trauma that caused them to feel a sense of safety with the weight. And I'm certainly not saying that's the case for everyone that has weight issues whatsoever. But in this subgroup, that was what was going on. And so the doctors were thinking, oh, my gosh, what else is happening that's affecting adults from their childhood? What else is going on that's creating physical and psychological issues in adult life due to childhood issues and trauma? And so they created this 10-question survey called the ACE survey, or the Adverse Childhood Experience Survey. And they pushed it out through an insurance network in California. And they had around, I believe, 17,500 participants who took part in answering these questions. And then they tracked and monitored this 17,500 participants over around 20 to 25 years. And what they found was absolutely staggering. They found that those that scored four or more ACEs, so basically if you'd answer yes to any of the questions, either a yes or a no question, an example of some of the questions would be, was anyone incarcerated in the household in which you lived up until the age of 18? Did your parents divorce? Did you observe or experience any physical violence? These kinds of questions that create adverse childhood experiences. And so any yes to those is one ACE. And so what they discovered is that the participants that had scored four or more ACEs from childhood that in adult life experienced, and I'll give you some rough numbers on the statistics, over two times more likely to have cardiovascular disease, over two times more likely to develop cancer, over two times more likely to suffer from obesity, over five times more likely to experience depression, are seven times more likely to be to have an alcohol use disorder, I believe around eight times more likely to be a perpetrator of domestic violence, around 10 times more likely to have suicidal ideation. But then here's another thing they found. They found that if a participant or if you'd scored five or more on the ACE survey, that you were 37.5 times more likely to attempt suicide.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
And so the reason why I think that's so powerful, especially when we look at first responders, for example, within the first responder world, I primarily work with law enforcement. And with law enforcement, you may know some of these stats, or you do, I know, because you've covered this stuff. But for every one line of duty death, there's roughly four officers who take their lives with suicide. And so when we look at these numbers, they're staggering and they're 100% unacceptable. But on a more subtle note, I believe that if we were to do a forensic study, we would see really high ACE scores for a lot of these folks who are struggling with suicide, primarily because of the part of how we filter trauma and experience trauma is through, and we've talked about this before, is through one, temperament and personality, and two, how our past experiences play into the way we view and filter what we experience. And so when we experience a critical incident or a traumatic event, that is experienced through my personality and through my past experiences and how I'm reading what's going on. And that's what's determining how I interact with my experiences. And this is where post-traumatic stress or post-traumatic injury, as some like to call that, really manifests itself.
Do you think that also plays a role in people choosing these professions, of the helper professions?
you're hitting the nail on the head here, I think. Yes. And certainly not the case for everyone.
Sure.
Absolutely.
Sure.
But I do think there is a degree here we need to look at and realize what is the profile of someone that's coming into a helping profession, as you said, you know, law enforcement, military, first responding. Yes, there is a degree there. And I've seen this consistently in the therapy room and then also in the training that I do with special operations military and with, you know, high performing law enforcement. There is absolutely a consistency to things going on in childhood. And that could be something as simple and subtle as feeling bullied as a child or experiencing a sense of helplessness, hopelessness, and powerlessness. And coming to a place where there is some resources, perhaps, where they do feel a sense of, you know what, when I get older, I don't want that to ever happen to me or anyone else. Mm-hmm. And so therefore, that's where a lot of the passions and the calls and the drives come from for pushing into helping professions, because, you know what, I do want to be different. I do want to make sure that I can protect other people so they don't have to experience what I experienced. Now, once again, that is in no way, shape or form every single law enforcement or first responder or military, not at all. But it's absolutely consistent with what I see in regards to what shows up in the therapy room through childhood experiences. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So when someone has those kind of scores, those kind of experiences, and they are perhaps in law enforcement or in the fire service, what can they do to help mitigate some of the results of those kind of experiences that may impact them on their job?
Yeah, that's a good question. And this is where really the rubber hits the road on wellness and on what's available from a health perspective. So it's very important, first and foremost, to realize just because I may have had a difficult childhood or I may have experienced a lot of trauma in law enforcement, for example, you know, as we were talking about right before we jumped on the podcast, you know, we were discussing the rates in which, you know, one survey did small to mid-size agencies. They discovered that the average small to mid-size agency for an officer that has a career in law enforcement, a long career, sees an average of 188 critical incidences in a lifetime, or in a career rather. Mm-hmm. And you juxtapose that against a civilian who experiences between 1 to 5 critical incidences mm-hmm. in a lifetime. Mm-hmm. And so you see a massive amount of exposure to trauma just simply from putting on a uniform.
Sure. Yeah.
And so with that trauma comes, well, how do I interact with that trauma? How do I respond to that? How do I deal with that? And so absolutely having some tools are essential to know what to do with this stress that I'm experiencing. And so some of the things that I teach, one of the biggest things that I teach, and this might sound hippie woo-woo to some, but I know not to you, Conrad, and I know from some of the other guests that you've had on here before, I've seen it, actually breath work, extremely powerful. So the reason why that is something that's so helpful with stress or with PTSD or with trauma is because trauma is showing up in the body physically and cognitively in the way we interact with ourselves from a mental health perspective and others and our environment. But where they're connected, you've got the sympathetic nervous system and the parasympathetic nervous system. And the reason why I'm talking about this is because it's important to understand how breathwork plays into this. It's not just a bunch of hippie woo-woo stuff. There's a lot of real solid science behind this. And really where it shows up is this. The sympathetic nervous system becomes engaged when I feel a sense of threat, and that becomes activated and my glucose levels shoot up, norepinephrine, adrenaline. And then if my stress rages on long enough, cortisol will push through. And so these stress hormones are sort of considered like the bad guys in a way of what's happening to cause a lot of the physiological responses that takes place. And as we've talked about before and other guests, I'm sure, you know, on the neuroscience perspective within the brain, what's happening, the amygdala, you know, becomes highly activated under stressful situations and the prefrontal cortex in the brain shuts down. This is where all of our reason, rational, logical thinking and ability to make good decisions sits. And so this goes offline, our amygdala comes online, And that pushes us into fight or flight or flee. And this is the sympathetic arousal that's taking place within the body when stress is experienced, when trauma is experienced. So we look at the sympathetic side, and then we need to look at the parasympathetic side. The parasympathetic side is the exact opposite. This is part of the nervous system that enables us to relax. Like right now, you and I, hopefully, are in a parasympathetic state where we feel good, we're able to focus, we're able to rationally and logically use our mind the way we're engaging. We're not disjointed in looking around with fear. Our heart beat is not elevated. We're not sweating. Our fine motor skills are still intact. And internally, it's often called the rest and digest process with the parasympathetic nervous system, where internally our body is able to regulate itself well, we're able to digest our food, and we feel calm, we feel relaxed, we feel good. That's parasympathetic state. So the reason why I'm saying this stuff is because the one thing that ties both within the autonomic nervous system of the sympathetic nervous system and the parasympathetic nervous system, the one thing that ties both of those together that we can actually use to manipulate is our breath. And so if we use our breath, we're actually able to, from a sympathetic state, move from that to a parasympathetic state simply by elongating an exhale rather than an inhale. So if my exhale is longer than my inhale, I'm actually able to force my body into a parasympathetic state if I'm stressed out. And so that's why when it comes to first responders, when it comes to PTSD, when it comes to treatment for these things, is talk therapy necessary? Maybe. But you know what's more powerful than that, I think, is learning how to breathe correctly, is learning how to get these tools to gain control over my sympathetic reaction and responses. And so that's why breathing's so powerful. So for example, some of the different breathing techniques that I teach is there's the box breathing method, which is famously attributed to the Navy SEALs, which is where you breathe in for 4 seconds through the nose and hold for 4 seconds, then breathe out 4 seconds through the mouth and hold for 4 seconds, breathe in 4 seconds through the nose, hold for 4 seconds, breathe out for 4 seconds through the mouth, hold for 4 seconds. So it's like a box, four and four. Now, even though technically that creates, equilibrium between the two, it doesn't directly force into the parasympathetic state. It enables you to have a good middle ground reaction, which is good. Another one, which is called the sympathetic sigh or physiological sigh, I apologize. And that is was discovered back in the 30s. And there's a lot of research out on this now. Stanford University actually did an experiment with this, with stress response of the physiological sigh, box breathing, and having people meditate. And all three were effective, but they found the most responsive treatment for stress reduction was a physiological sigh. And we actually do this automatically. You might notice a little child when they get upset and they cry, they might take two short inhales like that, when they cry. Mm-hmm. Or I've got my service dog sitting over here right now, Fritzy. She's a German Shepherd and she's sleeping right now. But even dogs do it. You notice when they breathe, when they rest, they do that. And so the physiological sigh consists of one powerful inhale and filling the lungs the best we can, through the diaphragm or belly breathing, you call, then the chest, so filling up the lungs, and then one last short inhale, so like this through the nose, so, and then that last inhale actually helps pop open a lot of the tiny little air sacs within the lungs that help exchange the oxygen and the carbon dioxide. So when I do that, and then a nice long breath out. So it looks like this. I'll just repeat it real quick. So it's a long inhale with a short inhale. Might sound a little silly. You might look a little silly sometimes. But it, like, if, oh, wow, even just doing that then, I feel, I can physiologically feel, I can feel my body do that just from that little interaction of breath. So that's really powerful. Another form of breathing that I also teach is the Wim Hof method. And have you had anyone talk about
that? I've heard about it, but I have not had anybody talk about it on the show. So
yeah, it's pretty neat. So it's a lot more elongated and takes a lot more commitment than that simple breathing. And honestly, from a tactical perspective, the physiological sigh is the fastest breath work that you can use to engage to get yourself centered back in a parasympathetic, reasonable parasympathetic state. But the Wim Hof method is phenomenal. Its founder, Wim Hof, is a crazy Dutchman, I believe.
Yeah, isn't he the guy that goes into like ice buckets and baths and stuff? Yeah,
crazy world records.
Right. Yeah,
he ran a marathon in a pair of shorts in the Atlantic Circle and half a marathon without water in the Sahara Desert or something like that. I mean, he's done all these crazy things, not to prove how great he is, but to prove, hey, you know what? You can actually train your body to do amazing things. Mm-hmm. And so the Wim Hof method is a series of breathing combined with cold exposure, which is very popular these days, cold plunge tanks, combined with commitment. They're the three pillars of the Wim Hof method. Mm-hmm. But the breathing process is basically you take 40 very, very deep, purposeful breaths, inhale, belly breathing to the chest, and then long breath out. You do that 40 times. And then on the 40th breath, you hold at the bottom of that 40th breath for as long as you can. So you want to try to go at least a minute of holding your breath if you're able to. And then you inhale, take another hold for about 15 seconds, and then that's one cycle. So you do that a total of four times. So it's quite a commitment. It takes about 17 to 20 minutes to do that whole process. Wow. But the results are phenomenal. You feel a dramatic sense of calm, a dramatic sense of peace. Some folks even have almost out-of-body experiences from that process. It's very, very powerful. And definitely not something you want to do if you're operating machinery or near a body of water or in the bath because you might have a reaction to it that where you might not feel completely yourself. And so you want to make sure you're in a safe place when you do that. But that's a super powerful tool to help, once again, mitigate and manage the sympathetic and the parasympathetic state that we're in. So the breathwork side of things is very powerful, and it's kind of fun seeing a bunch of first responders sit around breathing deeply.
So what are these tough, badass men and women? What's their response to when you put them through these paces?
Yeah. Well, that's a good one. Well, first of all, you kind of got this look like, oh my God, here we go. There's another death by PowerPoint. At least we don't have to be out in the hot or the cold outside kicking indoors. We'll just chill and relax for the day. And they kind of look at you with this bless me if you can look, but what I find is that especially after we do that initial assessment, and then when I get a high result return and I say to them, hey, you know what? 60% of you guys, based on what you just scored, most likely have PTSD. And I was sharing with you, before we got on about recently I was teaching at a state police chief conference and did the same thing, did my full presentation. First thing, had them do that assessment, but it wasn't a 60% response of PTSD. It was an 81% response.
And these are chiefs.
Yeah. Chiefs, the chief of police of basically a whole state. We're in this training, and I won't say which state it was, but
wow,
81%.
Wow. Mm-hmm. And why do you think that is? That number was higher. Was it because all these men and women have been in office or doing the work longer? Is that a reason?
I think part of it. Yeah, when you look at the amount of critical incidences first responders are exposed to the longer they're in their profession, absolutely. Mm-hmm. One. Two, also, you can take a look at the Fraternal Order of Police study that came out a year or two ago. Sherry Martin, I think you've probably had her on the show.
Yeah.
I love Sherry. Where they indicated that actually critical incidences and responses to critical incidences are the third most stressful thing for law enforcement. The first two, operational stress and organizational stress. Yep. And so, from executive leadership for the chiefs, they're dealing with all the operational stress and the organizational stress.
Yep.
And in fact, one of the police chiefs called out as I started teaching this training, and he was talking, he used some very colorful language in describing the stresses of not being able to please everyone. And the way that, you know, that who do we have to talk to, you know, because they're the top, you know, they're the hog of the trough, if you want to say. Right. And this sense of isolation as well in leadership, which is really dangerous. But I think that all plays into why their stress levels are so high, and even more so why training like this and why resources and tools like this are so important. Because one thing I did ask, you know, this group of police chiefs, and, you know, they've all got, I mean, the amount of experience in that room was just phenomenal. But I asked them, I said, hey, put your hand up if you know another officer who's retired and died not long after they retired. 100% of the hands went up. 100%.
Wow.
And that really plays into something else you're probably aware of and maybe talked about prior to us chatting, is that, you know, in the first responder world, and once again, I mainly work with law enforcement, within the law enforcement community, just signing the dotted line to become an officer automatically, statistically reduces 20 years of your life.
Wow. Yeah. So I want to ask you this. So a friend of mine is with a law enforcement agency, and I won't say where or this is, but he's been invited to be a part of this team to review their scheduling system or their scheduling, I guess, how they schedule for shift work. Well, currently this agency does so, all the officers, they work swing shifts. So this officer himself, he works days 1 week, he works evenings the next week, and then he works nights the next week. Yeah. And he says, it's horrible. I can't get sleep anytime. And so they're reviewing that now, and he's needing to like have some ammunition to come to the powers that be to say, hey, this is bad. What would you say to that kind of system?
I would say, yes, you're right. It's very bad. So when I was in law enforcement, we had month shifts. So we were 12-hour shifts. It was like four on, three off, you know, three on, four off. And each month you'd rotate between night and day. So a night shift would begin at 6 p.m. and end at 6 a.m. A day shift would begin 6 a.m., end at 6 p.m. That was hard on a month. I couldn't imagine doing what that is. Where it's weekly. And here's the reason why that's so dangerous, is the circadian rhythm that's required for our bodies to have the regular routine of sleep is 100% messed with. And what's the number one problem that really the majority of law enforcement officers, I believe, suffer from is a lack of sleep, hands down. Lack of sleep. You know, folks come in, you know, to see me, they'll sit on the couch in the clinic and they'll talk about all of their problems. And, you know, they've got anxiety, they've got depression, whatever's going on there. But honestly, before talking, what we really need to be doing is looking at sleep. And that's one of the first things I ask. Tell me, hey, what's your sleep cycle like? You know, how good of a quality sleep are you getting? Because we need to be getting at least 8 hours of sleep a night. Or day, depending if you're on shift, right? And then looking at, okay, well, next, what's your nutrition like? You know, how are you feeding your body? Are you feeding your body and fueling it with fuels and healthy foods that it needs? Or you find yourself pushing into like a radical eating where you've got major insulin dives and dumps and spikes and peaks because you're just all over the place in how you eat and what you eat. And then lastly, exercise. And, you know, surprisingly, you'd think law enforcement are pretty fit, but a lot of agencies don't implement any kind of PT test.
You got to pass it up to get in, right?
Right.
And then that's it.
And I think that the reason why, I think a lot of leadership in law enforcement are out of shape and they don't want to have to do it themselves. Well, I might be wrong, but I hope I'm wrong. But yeah, there's no standard. Now, in the federal government, there is. They've got standards in regards to physical fitness. But local agencies, state agencies also should have those standards too.
I love what Dr. T talks about. She talks about a little bit in the film, but her whole group, you know, focuses on and treats first responders as elite athletes. You know, these sports teams, they spend millions of dollars on nutrition, on exercise equipment, and on all the things to help their athletes perform at peak performance, because that will help them win, right? So why wouldn't that be important for first responders who take care of our communities? For these people to be at their peak performance and put in the resources that they need to be at peak performance so that they can take care of our communities properly.
100%. Yeah, no, Dr. T over there in Texas is completely on the money with that. And what she's doing is looking at a holistic approach to fitness, not just mental, physical, is where should be the gold standard of what's applied and supplied and supported for law enforcement and first responders nationwide, hands down.
Yeah, and so what in your work with agencies, with three-letter agencies around the country and with local agencies, what frustrates you the most?
Well, we're recording here, so I gotta be careful.
Share what you can.
I think there's a consistent struggle we all have. Mental health professionals across the board is, yes, the stigma is there and it's real. That's a problem. But the bigger problem a lot of the times that I've seen and observed agencies across the board is just a misunderstanding of how to handle issues when it comes to mental health problems. I'll give you one example from, I won't name the three-letter agency in particular that I was working with at the time. They had one of their special agents come forward and say, hey, I think I've got PTSD, maybe a TBI, and I just need some help. First thing they did, took away the gun, took away the badge. And you know this, you've worked with enough cops to know that that's the worst thing you could do.
Yeah.
The worst thing you could do. And not only that, for the psychological well-being of that specific agent, but also what sort of message does that send to all of the other agents, to all the other first responders when they see someone put their hand up and go, hey, I got an issue here, and then to see them almost penalized and disciplined for it, it says, hey, you know what? Yeah, I'm not putting my hand up here.
So now you have operators out there not saying anything, not getting help, and doing the work in they're unhealthy.
Absolutely. And that's one of the things I do appreciate about the DEA is, they are making efforts really with some of their programs. For example, they fund the program that I put on for all of the SWAT guys, SRT guys. And so they are attempting to make strides there, which is really impressive. But even you take it down to the local level, out of the federal level, and, I was contacted by one SO, a sheriff's office, because one of their deputies came forward and said, hey, I think I've got a drinking problem and I want to go to rehab. I mean, that's amazing, first of all, that deputy had enough insight to realize, you know what, yeah, I need to. He was drinking basically a fifth a day. He was killing himself, And, of course, that affected his ability to do his job and all. But they contacted me because they want me to do a psych eval on this guy, right? And fair enough to the degree. I understand that from a liability perspective for the agency or the sheriff's office. But once again, what's the optics in that? What's that sending out to the other guys? What's it saying? Hey, well, you got a problem. Keep your mouth shut. Don't come forward. And I think that right there is the biggest issue amongst first responders, period. It's not just that we've got a stigma issue of like the actual, first responders themselves not wanting to come forward as much as leadership, not really providing a safe, secure environment to be able to, realistically talk about these things.
So on the flip side of what bothers you or what frustrates you, what gives you hope? Where have you seen the needle change to a better place in the conversation around these things?
I think when we can provide realistic training with realistic solutions, when we do that, guys are like, yeah, I get that. When we start talking about performance, when we start talking about, hey, you want to be the best agent you can be, you want to be the best soldier you can be, you want to be the best law enforcement officer, the best firefighter, the best medic, the best 911 operator, whatever that is, let's look at some tools and some resources to maximize who you are and your capabilities. Let's look at ways that we can help shape you as a force multiplier in your environment. You know, let's use language like this instead of, oh, you know, you're struggling with mental health. You're struggling with depression, anxiety, or PTSD. Yeah, no one wants to talk about that. But hey, you know what? If there's a way I can be better at what I do, and especially like with a lot of guys I work with the high performing first responders and military, yeah, everyone there, man, they're like, they want to be the best they can be, you know? As it is the case with the majority of first responders. And so when you frame it, and in a way, I think what we need is to redo the lexicon around how we talk about mental health. And so what I try to do in my trainings is not even use the words mental health. You know, but let's focus on performance. Let's focus on tools to make you the most effective operator that you can be. Oh, that gets the guy's blood pumping when you talk like that. And I will say, you know, the in the military side with special forces, they've got the HPW program, Human Performance and Wellness, and you know, that's, I think they're attempting to try to do that. So they're probably slightly ahead of some other organizations with that. Still a long way to go, but I think that's the start, is changing the language.
Maybe I need to change the title of my film.
No, I didn't. I love the title of your film. Any outlook for it. It's brilliant.
So let me ask you this. So if there's an agency out there, if there's a chief, assistant chief, whatever, watching this, looking at this, and they want to bring you out to their agency, what needs to happen to make that happen?
Well, thank you. just get a hold of me. My website is tacpre.com. That's TACPRE.com. That's for tactical resilience. And that's got all my info on there. It's got a good blurb about what I do. Just shoot me an email or give me a call through that. All my information's on there. And absolutely, we'd love to figure out what we can do to make that work. And honestly, Conrad, the goal here is getting this message out. It's not to build my brand or to build or to make money on it. I obviously need to cover my expenses, and so my wife doesn't divorce me. You know. But I do. I'm passionate about getting this message out. And honestly, I'm training other guys. I've got a special forces guy and a retired special agent from a three-letter agency that's coming on board to get trained in these processes and protocols to push out nationwide with other agencies, because I'm only one man. Sure. I can't do it all.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, I'm gonna send this interview to I think he's now a major with our local sheriff's department. He's a friend of mine. He was in my film Heroin's Grip. He was a sergeant back then, but he's worked his way up quickly up through the ranks over the past 4 years. And now he's kind of one of the main decision makers. So I'm going to send him this interview. Say, hey, you need to get Dr. B out here to Maryland. So
you got Dr. B and Dr. T.
Dr. T, yeah. Well, let me ask you this and we'll wrap it up. So in the next month or two, what's something fun you're going to do?
Some of the fun things, I'm getting to bring my wife on some of these trainings, not so much to do the trainings, because some of the things we're implementing with the stress inoculation side of the trainings is actually doing cold exposure. Mm-hmm. So dumping guys in ice water, which is fastest way you can engage your sympathetic nervous system and to teach how to, you know, control that. It's really cool. So she won't want to do that, but she gets to travel with me sometimes when I do go to places. So next month I'll be out in Los Angeles training the DEA SWAT guys, the SRT guys out there. So I'll get to have her come with me, and we're going to spend an extra weekend out there. Fun. So that'll be fun.
Very cool. Mm-hmm. So I've been trying this thing, and I don't know, it may not be, it's kind of cheating, but when I get in the shower, I'll do my shower thing, and then I turn the water cold for the last 30 seconds just to kind of try to get myself into that. Is that a good thing to do?
Absolutely. Now, provided that your heart is in a place to do it. So,
yeah, right.
You know, you have to say, you know, make sure, you know, you get medical approval to do this, just because if you've got heart condition, sure, or heart disease issues, you know, you get that kind of shock, yeah, to the system, yeah. Could be catastrophic. But yes, it is amazing. In fact, if every single listener and viewer would be able to start doing that, they would actually experience roughly a 400% increase in their dopamine.
Wow.
That's why when you finish, you notice you feel so, mm-hmm, alert, you feel really, mm-hmm, good, you feel alive, you feel like, man, I can do anything. So that's really good. And research shows you actually only need around 30 seconds to 2 minutes, mm-hmm, of cold exposure, either in a shower, which is good, especially this time, mm-hmm, of the year because it's really, yep, cold, or in a, you know, an ice bath, or throw some ice in the bath, or an actual plunge pool, mm-hmm, if you have one, or a chilled plunger. Dramatic health benefits for it. So yeah, that's, mm, good job.
Yeah.
I'm impressed, Conrad.
I'm trying. I didn't do it today, but I'm trying to be consistent with that, because I know that consistency brings better results when you do things like that. And I read something, actually, yeah, I saw I think it was an Instagram video, one of these self-help personal development coaches talked about the that other system that you mentioned earlier, where you do the 40 times. Yeah, the Wim Hof method. And he said he had three things he wanted you to do. He said, if you do these three things and you do it every day for a month, he said, it'll transform your life. He said, if it doesn't, I'll send you $100.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Putting his money where his mouth is. But you know what? He's saying that because it's the, yeah, truth. And it's funny because it's become such a fad right now, the whole ice bath, mm, thing, especially on social media, people videoing themselves do it. But it's the best fad in the world. And the beauty of it is it's not something that's just an actual fad. You go back and look through history. For example, in Scandinavian countries, you will see mothers or fathers with the strollers, with their babies in a stroller, going to the coffee shop, putting the baby in the stroller outside in the snow, in the cold, you know, in a negative degree, right, temperature, while they're inside having a cup of coffee. You might think that's cruel. No, what they're actually doing is they're helping build their child's immune, wow, system and strengthen their cardiovascular system and their lungs. And so, no, yeah, absolutely, there's massive benefits. That's nothing new to many other cultures and countries, mm-hmm, around the world. It's just, yeah, new to us.
There's an interesting video out on YouTube that I don't know if you're familiar with the guys from Yes Theory. So Yes Theory is this massive YouTube channel. They have like, I don't know, 8 million subscribers or something like that. But these four guys that started this channel, and they go do these crazy adventures. They went and met with Wim Hof in Scandinavia someplace. I forget, Finland or someplace, you know, in the cold. And then they did a bunch of stuff. They went into this, like this pond. I mean, this is in winter. Yeah. I mean, this is like cold Scandinavian winter. They went into the pond and they were in there, I forget how long, maybe 2 minutes. And like their skin was like, yeah, beet red when they got out, you know.
Yeah.
And then they went hiking. They summited a mountain wearing nothing, yep, but their skivvies.
Uh-huh. Yep.
And it was like, wow, that's crazy.
It is crazy. And I tell you what happens is you develop an immunity to it. So in the morning, I don't do this every morning, but several mornings a week, I will go down to outside. I've got a swimming pool, mm-hmm, and it gets very cold. It gets 45 to 50 degrees. And every morning I'll get in it.
Wow.
So I'll get in the sauna first for, you know, 12 to minutes to half an hour or so, depending on how much time I have. And then I'll go get in the pool and right up to my neck and just jump in. And it's exhilarating, as you've experienced with the shower. And but yeah, no, look, this does not just wonders for the physiological sides of what it can do for your body. It also does incredible things for your mind, because it's teaching you to purposely overcome pain. It's teaching you how to traverse the difficult things in life. And so it's practice for not only, you know, developing your tolerance to cold, it's practice for how to deal with stress in your life, how to deal with arguments when a significant other is maybe mad at you for something, instead of you reacting in this negative childish way of being able to gain control of who you are and respond in a loving, growing up, mature way. It gives you the opportunity to realize when the stresses of when the things hit the fan, as they say, and things aren't going the way you want them to, either at work or wherever in life, if you can develop this, the fortitude of practicing and disciplining your mind to have control over your responses and your reactions. It is one of the most powerful tools in the world that you could develop for yourself.
Awesome. So one final thing, what's one thing a first responder should do first thing tomorrow to start on this path to wellness?
First thing tomorrow is pick up, if you're going to pick up your phone, which most people do, instead of checking your email and checking the news or whatever your favorite social media is, text three people. Three people. Now, here's the deal. Here's the condition. They have to be people that you haven't spoken to for a while that you need to catch up with. And here's what I want you to do. Only say something as simple as, hey, hope you're doing well. Just thinking about you today. Have a good day. That's it. Nothing more than that. Just a real quick touch base to say hello. It does a few things. One, it helps you stay connected. And when we look at depression, and there's a depression is rampant in first responder world. One of the things depression does is isolate us, pulls us out of our tribe. And so this is a great way to actually use technology in a very, very positive way. And it helps you reconnect. So that's one. Two, it helps build and foster gratitude. And that is one of the most important fundamental foundations of mental health is gratitude. How is gratitude showing up in my life? How am I grateful for the things that I have in my world? And what am I doing to invest in the lives of others? And so that simple little text is a fantastic way to practice gratitude of just connecting with someone else. And it's also the third thing it does is that it blesses someone else's day. I mean, isn't it nice if someone that you haven't spoken to for a while is just like, hey, man, I'm just thinking about you. How you doing? Yeah. I mean, all of us, we're like, oh, as I'd say in the South, oh, God bless their heart, you know. Like, it's just so, it's just such a nice thing. And so across the board, it's a win-win-win three ways.
That's awesome. Well, I'm going to do that tomorrow morning. I'm actually going to do that.
Love it.
And I want to say.
I've actually done that to you sometimes, you every now and then. When you've received a text from me, it's been one of your texts.
So I remember that, especially after we lost Nicole. I remember I got a text from you, and that meant so much to me. So thank you. And thank you for being on the program again today. I really appreciate that. Always a joy to talk to you. So.
Oh, likewise, Conrad. Thanks for having me, and I really appreciate the opportunity, one, to share this stuff, but two, you know, just to catch up with you. It's
absolutely
been good.
Phil, thanks for spending time with me today on the podcast, and thank you for listening. And for all of you who have taken time to leave a review, I really appreciate that. And remember, you are not alone. If you need someone to talk to and don't know where you can turn, you can dial 988 for help. Be sure to tune in next week for another interview with an amazing first responder leader. Until next time, be well, take care of yourself and those around you, and go out and do something great in the world.